If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, welcome. Thank you for downloading the Times Redbox podcast. I'm Luke Jones. I'm sitting in for Matt Shawley all this week. Don't worry, Matt will be back next Monday. Today, there's absolutely loads in store. We're going to be talking about trade. We're going to be rifling through Liz Truss's in-tray. Australia is wrapping up somewhat, but what else does she have to be thinking about? That US free trade agreement, when on earth is that happening? An upgraded Canadian trade deal, is that on the cards? We'll brief you ahead. Also, we've got some of our pre-pandemic professors as well. First, though, our columnists. Today, Helen Lewis from The Atlantic and Rosamund Irwin from The Sunday Times. Can I start with your recommendations of rubbish television, please, Rosamund?
Oh, well, it's not rubbish at all, but everyone who hasn't yet seen it should watch the whole of Call My Agent. It's good fun.
It's a bit rubbish.
And it's witty. It has its moments of being very silly, particularly towards the end of the third series and the fourth series. But it's not rubbish, really. But it's definitely light and escapism TV.
I slightly bailed on that. Well, I did definitely bail on it during series one when I wasn't enjoying it. And then someone in this office here said, oh, well, it really gets good around sort of towards the end of series three. And it's like, I'm not spending that much time on it, to be honest. Helen, rubbish television for Rishi?
I mean, I don't believe in the designation of rubbish television. Television you enjoy watching is by definition not rubbish. Feel no guilt about this. But I am going to make Roz's recommendation look positively highbrow by saying, SAS Who Dares Wins.
That's
my Sunday night appointment viewing. What I really love is that actually it's stealthily a programme all about male mental health, right? How important it is if you were bullied at school or abused or whatever it might be to go and talk to a therapist and let it all out. But it's cunningly disguised through the medium of angry men who are killers shouting at right 2 inches from your face in the kind of Scottish Highlands. I love it. I can't get enough of it.
Can I also throw into this bucket 24 Hours in Police Custody? Absolutely fantastic television. I mean, a lot of it is just quite over dramatic, no comment interviews, but that is absolutely, I think it's the best of television. Anyway, move us on. Actual news stories. First thing I want to ask you about is what's happening with Naomi Osaka, four-time Grand Slam winning tennis champion, and she's pulled out of the French Open all because of this argument. She doesn't want to speak to the media. It's quite a sad state of affairs, Rosamund, isn't it?
I think it's really sad, and obviously her mental health is the priority here. There's an interesting point about interviewing, though. I mean, so I've done an awful lot of interviews, including with sports stars, and sports stars are always sort of media trained out of saying anything remotely interesting. You know, they're sort of taught to say absolutely nothing that's going to make a good headline. And I've always thought it's a real shame, because it means when you finally find one who actually says something interesting, they get a huge amount of attention on them because they're actually sort of speaking and saying something human rather than a kind of. But it's really sad that she finds this such a horrific pressure. And I mean, she did say that the media actually hadn't been that brutal to her. Though I do wonder if a lot of it as well is that it gets attention on social media where she may not have, you know, she's a woman and a non-white woman. And I do wonder if she gets abuse on social media because, you know, we've heard an awful lot about how much black footballers, you know, get abuse online and in person. So I did wonder if that was a dimension here and that that makes these appearances really hard for her. But I do find it really sad. And I do think the difficulty is, whilst obviously her mental health comes first, it is actually important that people speak to the media. You know, that there's a job to be done there that, that does matter. And I think trying to make it as painless as possible for people is really important. But also, you know, how do we make people comfortable with those conversations if they find them hard? It is a challenge.
Helen, what do you make of this? It is a difficult balance, but do you think it it tips either way in terms of more towards open access for the people covering these kind of tournaments or, you know, the well-being of the players?
Well, I think the problem is that if you look at the commercial aspect of this, there is no prize money in tennis if the games aren't televised, if the sponsors don't get the branding and promotion that they need. So even though, you know, she walked off court without doing the interview before getting chucked out of the tournament, you know, she still gave a television interview to, I think, a Japanese station because she's contractually obliged them as part of her sponsorship deal. Yeah. So quite a lot of this isn't about kind of evil media that's just desperate to ask people questions about why are you so rubbish at tennis immediately after someone's lost. It's a lot of it's about the fact that the people whose logo is on your trainers demand that you do that as a result in order to kind of fund your career and lifestyle. So I think that some of it goes to kind of default media bashing as if the media just love to tear people down. Well, actually, it's all part of a kind of quite complicated funding arrangement. That said, like Ross, I'm not going to die on the hill of defending the post-match press conference because I have to say, trying to think of one that has ever surfaced anything kind of vaguely interesting is not possible. So I think there's a broader principle, which is, yeah, these tournaments cannot exist without money, and that money is dependent on press coverage. But whether or not specifically the post, you know, why did you lose immediately after you've lost, you know, that is a different question, I think.
And also, as well as general mental health well-being, the point that Naomi Osaka makes is that it could necessarily impact on performance. If so much of elite sports, Rosamund, is about your mental state, that actually it could, you know, seriously damage actually how successful she is.
Well, absolutely. And I think that's a challenge, isn't it, for all sports stars. They've got to be incredibly resilient. It's a challenge probably for all of us, really. You know, you've got to, but particularly in sport where obviously incredibly high stakes, you know, people are screaming at you, you know, fans are screaming at you, or they're screaming, you know, in support of the other side. I've always wondered with tennis, you know, because it's one person on another, the difficulty is, you know, I watched a match where the crowd just sort of turned against somebody, and so they were all cheering for the other person, and I thought, what does that do to you to have, you know, the entirety of Wimbledon screaming the name of someone else, and, you know, totally supporting someone else? And I would think, yeah, that would be really deeply upsetting. You know, so it is a real challenge. I agree with Helen. The problem here, though, is, you know, all big sport now is so driven by finances that they've got to find ways to make the model work. And that way, you know, is to do with sponsorship and, I agree that this sort of does feel the default thing that the media gets blamed, whereas actually, you know, there's an awful lot of other stuff going on here.
Let's move on to an interesting story which broke in China yesterday. An announcement that, so at one point we had the one child policy. In 2015, okay, they upped that, you can have two children. Now, couples can have up to three children because of some quite worrying census data there showing a steep decline in birth rates. You think, Helen Lewis, why don't just, if you're now saying it's up to three, why not just say do what you like?
Well, actually, I mean, in a way that almost probably wouldn't matter because birth rates are, you know, have declined across the developed world and across Europe. There are very few countries where, I can't think actually of any European country where the average birth rate is above three anyway. In most countries now, it's around or below the replacement rate. The problem with this is that there's been a kind of rash of natalist policies in the last couple of years. So Hungary is the really obvious example. Viktor Orban, the very authoritarian prime minister there, said, you know, we don't want more immigrants, we want more Hungarians. So it was explicitly framed in this kind of xenophobic way. But they had kind of weird things like I think you get money off a people carrier if you have more than four children. And, I don't have kids, so I can't, speak to this. But I can't imagine that for many people, the decision about whether to have three or four children is contingent on some money off a people carrier. So what you have is these policies that kind of turn birth rates into a kind of political issue without really actually doing very much about them. And that's very worrying to me about when we look at the trajectory of birth rates across the developed world, about where that's going to go in the next couple of 100 years. Because really the rhetoric that's going to come out is we've given women too much education and now they don't want to have kids. And that's what underlies it, as well as the kind of racist belief that there are children being born in other countries, you know, particularly in sub-Saharan African countries, but not here. So actually, are we going to be kind of drowned out? And that's where you get the kind of great replacement racist conspiracy theories coming out. So it's a really, really tense and worrying subject.
And aside from vouchers for family cars, Rosamund, these are huge cultural shifts, aren't they? And actually, just a tweak in government policy isn't necessarily going to mean that all of a sudden everybody changes what they're doing, because I guess if you grew up in a China or a country where everyone was really just having one child, you might end up having one child just because that's what's happening around you. Similarly, if you live in a part of the world where people have loads more children, you're more inclined to do the same. So these kind of shifts will take absolutely ages to change in people.
Yeah, and it feels incredibly cruel to all of those who've been punished for having more than one child. And obviously, the most extreme end of that is, you know, forced abortions, forced sterilizations. But we're also talking about quite hefty fines. So I have a relative who lives in China. He married a Chinese woman and they have three children. And he has been heavily fined for that. And it's really hard to enroll the last child in any kind of education, in childcare, all of that stuff. They make it incredibly difficult. So, I mean, for him, obviously, this is good news because he's not going to be quite so cruelly punished for that. The difficulty for me, there's a broader point here. So Helen's absolutely right. We're going to see massive demographic changes. So Nigeria, which is currently probably about the seventh most populous country in the world, is going to become, over the next sort of 70 years, the second most populous country in the world. And you're going to have enormous pressure on resources there. I've been there fairly recently, pre-lockdown, obviously. Yeah. And, you know, just the queues of traffic in Lagos are horrific. I mean, you know, the pressure on all sorts of things is going to be terrible there. Whereas China is going to see a decline in the number of people as much of Europe is already starting or moving towards, obviously, migration sometimes means population continues expanding for a while. To me, the thing that our government's going to have to look at, because we've seen, having had a higher birth rate than countries like Italy and Spain for a long time, ours is starting to dip. And the problem with demographic issues is that governments tend not to look at them because they're long-term problems.
Yeah.
You know, a child today only enters the workforce in 20 or so years. So they tend to be heavily neglected by governments. But for me, the big thing, having just had a child, is, you know, statutory maternity pay is £600. You know, women can't afford to be out of the workforce. We've set up a society that relies on two incomes, and being out of the workforce is so wounding to your family finances that's incredibly difficult for people. And then the prohibitive cost of childcare as well. You know, I was looking at that, and around me, which is one of the most expensive places for childcare in the country, it'd be about £1,300 a month. Well, ooh. I won't have much money left. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's about the worst place in the country for full-time childcare. So I wouldn't have much money left once I paid my mortgage and that. You're sort of running to stand still, essentially. And obviously, you only get any free childcare when the child is three. So you've got these 2 years, potentially, where you're incredibly financially squeezed. So that's what I think that our country needs to look at. It needs to look at childcare costs and whether we're giving enough support to women when they're on maternity leave. And fathers, I should add, you know, paternity leave is really important too, because it stops this being a disproportionate penalty to women. And I'm reassured that some companies have started to equalise what men and women receive. And I hope more move towards that.
I'm going to ask you about the ongoing pandemic we're living through in a moment. But first, slightly more important matters. The wedding that happened in Downing Street over the weekend. And there's the interesting details that are slowly coming out through the papers about the extent, the length that we've gone to try and keep it secret. I read this morning, Helen Lewis, that Carrie Johnson rented 3 decoy outfits along with the white dress she rented, just so in case anybody spotted them being carried through the front door, they wouldn't think that a wedding was afoot. Very clever.
I mean, it was quite a well-executed... I mean, in a way, you think, I wish that they'd put her in charge of the COVID response.
Yeah, exactly.
Because this
yeah.
was a lot better planned from everything that
there
I can
see. There are plenty
see.
Of leak inquiries she can get her hands on.
Right, but yeah, I thought this was really interesting, actually. And the eco overtones of it are interesting. It's more than a kind of frivolous story on that point because, you know, we've got to this idea where, you know, I walked past a... Primark yesterday and there was a t-shirt on sale for £3 in the window and the cost of that is yes it's £3 to you and that seems brilliant but the cost of that both to the people who had to make that t-shirt and also to the environment and all the resources that's taken up for clothes to be so incredibly disposable is really high and it's a really kind of one of those unfashionable things to say but actually what you know I don't think that kind of renting clothes is going to make a huge dent in the problem immediately but it is a really interesting solution to go kind of why buy, you know, wedding dresses are one of the most wasteful things that you can buy. You know, people are spending thousands of pounds on stuff that you're only going to wear for, you know, 6 hours. It's extraordinary. And so that was, I thought that was a really interesting kind of, if that becomes something that it becomes more acceptable to do, I think both for people on a budget, that would be really helpful. And also for the environment too.
Because Rosamund, you see it for sort of very important moments, people renting clothes, men with tuxes, obviously, kilts for wedding people hire. There's a whole thing with ball gowns, isn't there, and for weddings and things that women can buy. But wedding dresses is a slightly separate thing, but also just everyday clothes. People are just always going to be snapping up £3 T-shirts, aren't they?
Well, like Helen, I hope that doesn't keep happening because the cost environmentally is so horrific of that. I mean, obviously, clothing as an industry is so damaging to the planet. On this, I mean, I find it a little bit sad, the idea of not wanting to hold on to your wedding dress, though. I mean, all for renting clothes generally, and I think she's given a really good advert to that service, I would say. They must be thrilled because it's a nice headline for Downing Street because it looks sort of frugal, doesn't it? When all this attention's been on how much money Boris Johnson spends and the redecoration. Exactly, the extraordinarily expensive wallpaper. So you can see why it looks good from their point of view, but it also great advert for renting clothes. But for me, I did buy my wedding dress, and I just feel with it that it is something that sentimentally somebody offered to buy mine a couple of years ago. So sort of picture, not a couple of years ago, a year ago, and I couldn't part with it. It was something I wanted to keep. Now, mine admittedly could be converted into a going out dress.
Yes. By removing no one ever thing. Does that, Roz. Stop
but
lying
no
to yourself.
Does.
No one ever,
exactly,
ever redyes
exactly
their wedding dress.
Exactly what I was going to say. Right, so mine isn't purely white. So it's not the colour. It's, you know, it's got pink flowers on it. And it could be used as a summer dress. But of course, part of you thinks, oh, I don't quite want to cut off the train, do I?
do you ever just pop it on? Just if you're at home alone, just think, well, I'll just walk around the house in this for a bit.
The tragedy would be having had a baby, I'm not sure it will fit entirely at the back. So that's an ambition to get back to. Yeah, I don't know. I worry that the zip wouldn't do up and I'd feel terrible about it. So at the moment it's even worse. It's at my parents. It's not even in our house. So it's just more rubbish for them that they've attracted. But yeah, I couldn't quite part with it. And I did think that was a little telling because I did weigh it. You know, they were making quite a generous offer on it. But I just couldn't quite bear to.
Very, very finally, can I ask you about the scenes we saw at Twickenham yesterday? Not rugby, but under-30s running, I saw in some videos, to go and get their jab yesterday. I hope, Helen, and I'm slightly annoyed because I think this might be the case, that the over-30s got appointments and schedules and things they can put in their calendar, and now we might be getting closer to kind of the there's 20,000 doses in this place, run, and people in their 20s will just do that.
Yeah, but as a fellow kind of conscientious planner ahead, I think you just have to accept that the world is built so that we have to allow people who don't plan ahead also to kind of get stuff and do stuff. And that's annoying. I feel like we're being punished for doing things right. But isn't it a wonderful problem to have? I mean, all this time about worrying about vaccine hesitancy and, you know, and other countries having problems with take up. And in Britain, we've got kind of 25-year-olds literally running to Twickenham because they're so desperate to get the vaccine. I know. It's I'm sure it upsets your planning heart, but yeah. This is objectively a good thing.
No, but also because it was sort of slightly out of reach, because I live in North London, and I saw this on Twitter yesterday afternoon. They said if you can get here for 7:30, and I was on Google Maps, I thought, okay, it'll take me an hour and a half to get there. I'll get there for, by the time I was through, it's going to be about 7:00. I thought, do I risk it? Then I saw online that there were lots of queues of people, and it just thought, is this what I'm going to have to go through to get my vaccine? It seems like such a pain now.
I suspect this is kind of more of a one-off, isn't it? I mean, they may have further ones of these, but they're still going to have to go through the whole of giving everyone a bit younger. I actually had mine on Monday, coincidentally.
Congratulations. So yesterday.
I know, and I have been incredibly envious of all these people posting about it. And then I joined in and probably made all the 20-somethings really annoyed by saying, yeah, finally. But it was incredibly... So I had mine at Roehampton. Queen Mary's car park, and it was a really efficient thing. I was incredibly impressed, all these lovely volunteers.
Yeah.
And I just did think it was an incredibly well-run thing, whereas some people have told me they've had a long wait when they've had theirs, but nothing like that at all. It was just amazingly efficient. It did make me feel really proud.
Helen Lewis from The Atlantic and Rosamund Irwin from The Sunday Times. Next, one of our pre-pandemic professors.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Time for another one of our pre-pandemic professors. Every day this week, we're going to hear about the life and times of one of our favourite COVID experts, because other than hearing them all the time on the radio talking about COVID, what do we really know about them? They've had lives and careers pre-pandemic, so all this week we're going to ask them about them. Yesterday we heard from Professor Linda Bald.
Linda Bald is a Professor of Public Health at...
In a moment we'll hear from Professor Linda Bald.
Linda Bald, Professor of Public Health at Edinburgh University.
Welcome to Linda Bald, who's
Professor of Public Health at the University of Edinburgh, Linda Bald.
And how she was a big part of these Stop Smoking campaigns in the late 90s. Today, the person we often turn to for insight into variants and vaccines, Professor Danny Altman.
Danny Altman.
Danny Altman.
We'll ask Danny Altman.
Professor of Immunology,
Danny Altman.
Danny Altman.
Danny Altman, good morning.
Hello.
Thank you very much for your time this morning. First of all, could we start off by the way we introduce you all the time is talk about you're a Professor of Immunology at Imperial College London, but you also work in a lab in the Hammersmith Hospital. Could you just sort of lay out what your work is at the moment? Maybe if it's more useful to do so, what it was just before the pandemic.
Yes, so just before the pandemic, we were doing, I suppose, quite related things, kind of global health, infectious disease, immunity to infectious disease. I'm very keen on studies in Brazil on a virus called chikungunya, in Vietnam on a bacterium called Burkholderia. And then, you know, the pandemic came and we became a lab working 24/7 on COVID.
Doing what?
Well, this was a virus that we knew absolutely nothing about. We got the sequence of it on January the 11th, 2020. And as a lab where we had a lifetime of experience trying to understand immunity to infectious diseases, there was a whole, medical textbook chapter to be written. Mm. Think about, 100 people get infected with the same virus. Some of them are untouched by it. Some of them get rather severely affected and some of them die. You know, what's the difference?
And in terms of those other viruses and infections that you listed there that you're working on pre-pandemic, tell us about one of those and how you've come to work on that and what the challenges are with some of them.
Yeah, so one of the ones that I do love and I'm very interested in, I love them all, but chikungunya virus in Brazil is an interesting one and very relevant to, it kind of informed our thinking about COVID. So this is a virus that you catch from a tiny mosquito, a bit like Zika or dengue or something, and you feel feverish and unwell and have a rash. And the reason it's terribly pertinent at the moment is that 30 or 40% of those people even once they recover from the virus, will have a chronic disability, a kind of arthritis, that keeps them out of work, unwell, going back to clinic for years afterwards. So you can see the analogy there with long COVID, and that really quite informed our thinking.
Mm. I'm going to rewind right back to the beginning, if I can, and ask you about your parents, because it seems like they had incredible lives, each of them.
Yes, I come from one of those interesting London German Jewish Holocaust survivor families, where you know, it was a matter of coming to England, you know, post concentration camp, and trying to rebuild a family, which they did.
And your dad, is it right that he fled on Kristallnacht? He was sort of, his family were caught up in that.
Yes, so he came with his brother. They were 9 years old and 11 years old, and arrived, you know, with their cardboard suitcases and nothing else, and had to rebuild their lives as orphans. Yes.
And for your mother's part, she arrived in the UK after she was liberated from Auschwitz.
Yes, yes. So, you know, a rather kind of devastated family, where they settled in London and tried to rebuild a family, I guess, as they'd remembered it in their childhood.
And in terms of your first sort of associations with science in the household, was that something that other people were interested in? Did either of your parents work in that when you were growing up?
No, I don't think there was much science around me. But to be honest, I'm not really sure all these decades later if I am a scientist or if one ever becomes a scientist. Science is just telling stories, really, which we all like doing.
But what actually got you onto your first, well, it was a degree course at the University of London. What was it, in microbiology?
Yeah, I just, you know, I'm curious about lots of things, like as many of us are. And I loved immunology from a very young age. So as a, who knows, as a 18-year-old or 19-year-old, I went to hear a lecture by the person who just won a Nobel Prize, Rolf Zinkernagel, who discovered much of what we talk about now, about how T cells work and are restricted in their behaviour. And it really triggered something in me.
And in fact, your PhD, that was to do with T cells, wasn't it? Just explain what those are for those thickos like me listening.
Yes. So to people like me, T cells are really mission control in protective immunity. They're the intelligent white blood cells that say if there's something going wrong, whether it's a tumor or a bacteria or a virus, and think of clever, appropriate ways to respond to it. So I arrived at University of Bristol in September 1980 for the first day of my PhD. And my supervisor said, you seem to understand about T cells. Why didn't you just do something on that? And I did.
And what were you looking at specifically?
I was it was kind of the home of herpes viruses, things, everything from Epstein-Barr virus that causes glandular fever and cancers and things, to herpes, both the cold sore version and the gentle version. Mm-hmm. So it was that family of viruses. And at the time, not much was understood about how they were controlled by T cells. So I spent 3 years having a whale of a time in Bristol, both socially and scientifically, trying to sort out my little bit of it.
And as you moved on through your career, your scientific career, I wonder what were the sort of big unanswered questions or areas that were concerning and interesting you?
Well, I think the thing I'd say is that it has been a very lucky time to be an immunologist, because I'd argue that of all the branches of modern medicine and molecular medicine, it's had some of the biggest breakthroughs and biggest returns. You know, at the beginning, we were trying to understand things like, you know, how would you make a really effective modern vaccine against an infectious disease? Or what is an autoimmune disease? Or how could you turn on the immune response to resist tumors better and cure cancers? And all of those things have come and been delivered in my professional lifetime. Not all of them, obviously, personally by me, although I've, you know, played little parts in all of those stories. But what an exciting time to be doing this job.
And also, even if you weren't necessarily involved with some of those breakthroughs, you've been involved for quite a while, it seems, with journals and research publications. You're the editor-in-chief of Oxford Open Immunology. For 20 years, you edited the British Society for Immunology journal. So all of these interesting things that were happening, you had to be across and were coming across your desk.
Yes, so part of my job is I do love everything to do with how we communicate science, how we tell the stories, how both scientifically and, you know, with our colleagues and also to the public. So as you said, I've spent more than 20 years as an editor, also as an educator and lecturer to students. Because, you know, what is science? It's thinking of a really important question that hasn't been answered yet, trying to think of an experiment, a way of resolving what the answer is, and then finding some really beautiful words to communicate it to people so they'll understand it and believe you. So that's what I do.
And finally, Professor Altman, what about away from the science? What do you do to unwind? I'm thinking hobbies here.
Not that much time anymore for hobbies, but I've got quite a busy, demanding family. I also paint and draw a lot. And my really big love is heavyweight literature. So every morning, 5 to 6 a.m., I'm in my bath reading Tolstoy or Zola or Hardy or Wolfe or something. And, you know, happy as Larry.
When did you get into that habit?
Oh, like many of these things, long ago, you know, a girlfriend saying, you know, do you actually read any serious books? And thought, God, I'd better get onto this.
So what are you reading at the moment?
I'm reading some Zola. Yeah. And, you know, one of my favorite authors. I'd recommend him to anybody who hasn't picked one up.
That was Danny Altman, Professor of Immunology at Imperial College London. We'll have another professorial biography tomorrow as well. Next, we're going to be talking trade.
We import 9/10 of all of our pears. We import 2/3 of our cheese. That is a disgrace.
There is a pandemic on, the NHS almost toppled over twice, and businesses up and down the land have been interrupted, starved, or just totally killed off. Not quite the post-Brexit wonderland the government were hoping for, but work has continued on the international trade front. Many EU deals have been rolled over, and Liz Truss has started work on new free trade deals. Beyond that, we're going to be going through her intro this morning, hear about what's afoot with the US and Canada from specialists there, and also the chair of the Commons International Trade Committee will be live as well. First, Australia, the deal that has been concerning government most at the moment. The Prime Minister set a deadline the other day to outline an agreement with Australia by the G7 summit. That's in 11 days from now. This would be the first deal to be built from scratch post-Brexit. Live with us this morning, Alexander Downer, former Australian Foreign Minister and High Commissioner to the UK. Good morning.
Good morning.
First of all, on that deadline by the G7, with all the issues which we keep hearing about, do you think that's likely?
Yes, I think that can be done. There's been a good year of negotiations that have taken place, and the sides have covered 7 or so different chapters of negotiations, looking at everything from services trade to goods trade through to recognition of qualifications and so on. So there are a whole lot of issues that have been covered. Most of them are quite easy to cover, and it just boils down to reaching an agreement on goods trade. So Australia offers completely free access for all British exports into the Australian market without any tariffs and without any quotas, and obviously the Australian side expects that to be reciprocated, yeah. And then the deal can be done.
Mr. Downer, it sounds like you're on the other side of the room from your microphone. I wonder if you could find where it is and get a smidge closer. I'm also interested about the extent to which the beef issue, which we've been hearing so much about with this UK-Australia trade deal, might hold things up. I'm thinking particularly about the farming lobby in Australia and how fiercely they will fight this access to British markets for their beef.
Well, I mean, the Australian farmers have been decades champions of free trade, and they've never worried about competition from abroad, and wouldn't have thought British farmers worried about that either. Prospered by being an open and free market. Australia, it's not Australian farmers. I mean, the Australian government and the Australian parliament are of the view that if we offer the UK free access to the Australian market, that'll obviously adjustments for businesses will we expect to be reciprocated.
Mr. Dan, I think we're going to leave it there because the line is not the best, but I think we just about got the gist. Thanks very much for your time. That's Alexander Downer, former Australian Foreign Minister and High Commissioner to the UK on the Australian-UK trade deal, which is in the works. Also on Liz Truss's to-do list is the US. The UK government very keen to strike up an agreement with them. But how has the transition from Trump to Biden affected this, and is chlorinated chicken really still the big issue? We've been hearing from Hilary Fordwich from the British American Business Association.
President Biden, of course, has Irish roots and has been very forceful with his sort of disregard and lack of support for Brexit initially. Now, I do think he's under a lot of pressure from American farmers, finance, and the whole data and technology industry to have a US trade deal completed with the UK. A few issues and where there are sticking points, and it looks like there are some positive areas and sticking points. One of the sticking points, interestingly enough, looks like it will be with regard to the NHS. Of course, the National Health Service, held with great regard, you know, the minds and the souls and the hearts of the British public, particularly through the COVID epidemic. And the US pharmaceutical industry, which has immense power and a lobbying force, wants to have access to promote drugs to the UK and to have the NHS purchase them probably at a higher price than they already do. So that would put financial pressure on the NHS. So that's one of the issues. Another of the issues, of course, is agriculture with regard to chicken. And we've often heard about the chlorinated chicken, yes, coming from the US, but also the hormones that are given to the beef industry and the cattle in the US, and also pork, the rearing sort of practices in the US. So they're called the sanitary and phytosanitary standards, the SPS, and these standards would have to be lowered somewhat, either from the UK side or raised from the US side. So there is talk about lowering, as a sort of a back entrance route, lowering tariffs and making US farm products that don't use hormones, making them more able to be exported to the UK, because that would open up another channel. And of course, in the US, you know, many of us buy our foods that don't have that aren't chlorinated and don't have the hormones in specialty stores. I think you'll see tariffs removed and lowered on those to encourage that to be possible.
So actually, that seems like a very neat workaround. So it doesn't sound like, yeah, it will be the great sticking point that maybe it's been talked up to be.
Let's hope not.
Yes. And in terms of timescales, we're talking years here, aren't we?
Well, let's hope not. The Biden administration is looking to do as much as they possibly can to get things done, because obviously they want to look good. There's a midterm election coming up in 22. So the Biden administration wants to have as many wins under their belt as possible. So what does that mean? You'd think, well, you know, the public's voting, yes, but the lobbies in the US have immense power. So I mentioned the agricultural lobby. There's Dave Salmon. He is the head of the US Agricultural Farmers, the lobbying wing of that organization. And he's already said, to your earlier point, that the US farmers are watching very closely those negotiations that are going on with Australia to see how far the UK is willing to go in terms of standards. Yes. So when you look at the time frame, you look at the US lobby. So we've got agriculture, and then there's the tech industry. Another issue here is, in the UK, there are greater protections for the individual who uses technology and data protection, as well as financial protection, higher standards than there are in the US. And that is something that both sides are going to have to negotiate. What will that mean? Which side is willing to concede to make sure that there's agreements? I think the overriding big picture here is that it's in the interest of both nations to get a deal done as quickly as possible. So actually, no, I don't think it will be years. I think it will be before the 22 midterms, so that the Democrats can list something else under their belt.
But in terms of the body of work that's needed to go through, because I guess the UK didn't already have an existing free trade agreement with the US via its membership of the EU, there is so much up for grabs, as you say.
There is, absolutely, yes. And something that I haven't mentioned, of course, is, in addition to all of those and the NHS, et cetera, you've got the data protections. We didn't talk about the financial industry. Well, the financial industry in the US wants access to the City of London. That is a vast lobby. You have the whole, obviously, you know, New York power brokers and the weight and the influence that they have. They want greater access. So they want access to the City of London. And they want that because, of course, now with the regulations changing with regard to the EU, there's been a lot of US banks, for example, Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, setting up operations in the UK. So the UK wants to make things as appealing as they possibly can for the financial sector.
Hilary Fordwich of the British American Business Association on the prospects of a UK-US trade deal. We'll move deeper into Liz Truss's in-tray now and think about Canada. I was hearing from Colin Robertson, Vice President and Fellow at the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, who told me that whilst there were lots of opportunities to be created from an enhanced free trade deal with Canada, Canadian businesses, most of all, were looking for continuity from the current trading system with the UK.
Well, I think the average person who trades wants to have continuity. He doesn't want to have any interruptions because the UK is such an important trading partner, not just for goods, but also for services. And there's a lot of investment coming from the UK into Canada. So essentially what Canadians want is continuity. And I think we'll take this opportunity to perhaps take a look at how we can update and make some improvements. The base is going to be the Canada-Europe, what we call the Comprehensive Economic Trade Agreement, which had been negotiated with the UK and the other members of the European Union 4 years ago. After it took about 10 years. And so, and Britain was a major player in that. Britain in particular pushed hard on the Strategic Partnership Agreement, which is separate from the trade agreement, but covers almost everything else: politics, defense, security, science, cooperation, that kind of thing.
And so what is left maybe, first of all, on the table for the Canadians in terms of enhancing the agreement with the UK, what actually might they want to do that goes beyond what's already been agreed?
Well, I think we'll take a look at the investment chapter, an investment dispute chapter, which has been quite controversial within Europe and is probably holding up the ratification by the member countries. The issue would be what we call investor dispute. What it means is that if a government body is involved in something, it can be argued that this is constitutes a subsidy or interference by that government.
Yes.
And there are also sub-state actors. Canada, of course, is a federation. Our provinces are involved, and our provincial governments sometimes take legislative, particularly in a regulatory front related to, say, the environment. They may say a certain additive that is used in Britain is not permissible here. That would potentially give the British exporter grounds for liability action if this action happened after they'd already had an existing trading relationship.
Interestingly enough, though, whenever we talk about these trade deals, I mean, we just heard in terms of the UK one with Australia, the thing holding that up is beef cattle farming, and that seems to be the point of dispute, especially here in the UK. With the American one, it's the idea of chlorinated chicken all of a sudden entering our markets. And with the Canadian one, weirdly, to continue the food theme, Boris Johnson only the other day saying that the UK was eager to secure a much more wide-ranging deal with Canada because he wants to get affordable, high-quality British cheese to Canada.
Right. And you've just put your finger on it. We have different standards. As you say, the Americans have what they call chlorinated chickens. The Australians, like the Canadians in their beef, probably use hormones. To your point on the cheese and dairy products, we work on a kind of a quota system so that farmers can produce so much milk product, which goes into cheese, which of course is at issue here. And to preserve that, we have very high tariffs ranging from 250 to 300%. Gosh. Effectively, this keeps out any foreign cheese because the tariff is prohibitive. But what we have negotiated over time with trading partners is what we call tariff weight quotas. And in other words, there's a certain amount of cheese that Britain could export to Canada without the tariff supplying. It's very low. We've only opened up about 4% of our market. When we negotiated with the European Union, the Comprehensive Economic Trade Agreement, the British were pushing us hard to open up our dairy market, essentially cheese market. And we did, But of course, the European Union, when Britain Brexited from that,
yes,
they kept most of those quotas. So the British will be starting, in a sense, from a more vulnerable position, because they'll be saying, well, we'd like to now to increase that access to the Canadian market. The Canadian dairy farmers are going to say, not a chance. We've already opened up our market to the Europeans and to the Americans. We're talking about a politically powerful group of farmers who have significant votes within, particularly within Quebec, which is always our battleground province, and to some extent in Ontario. So that's going to be a heavy lift on the British side.
What are the heavy lifts do you think there might be? And what are the key objectives made from the Canadian side? You touched on services,
beef
financial
and pork.
Beef and pork. Oh, so just more
yeah.
farming goods. Yeah.
I don't think there'll be much on the services side. I think there'll be broader agreement. Mm. We'll be pushing for things like mutual accreditation. That is, can a lawyer who's accredited in Britain practice in Canada? Well, yeah. Perhaps they may have to pass a bar exam, or an architect, or an engineering firm. You know, data is now the new gold. And so how are we going to manage that? The data flows, I think, is going to be something important. And that's where this might be path breaking, because I think both British and Canadian negotiators will say, okay, maybe we can set the standard, which then the rest of Europe might take and the United States might take. This is fallow ground for, I think, some degree of experimentation and development, which could have broader application. You know, we had an agreement with Britain, I think, before Brexit, when Liam Fox was the trade minister, but then he went out and said, well, we're going to reduce all tariffs, at which point Canadian negotiators said, well, why would we do an agreement with Britain if they're going to reduce all their tariffs? Mm. The British government has since changed how they've approaching these trade agreements. And that's why we should be able to work this out. And from a British perspective, it's important because Canada is a integral member of two trade plurilateral agreements that the United Kingdom would like to get access to. First, the United States. So if you work a deal out with Canada, in a sense, you set the stage, because the standards that you'll have to meet would be roughly equivalent to the standards that already apply to North American free trade and to the truly high-level Trans-Pacific Agreement that already exists and includes notably Japan.
Colin Robertson, Vice President and Fellow at the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, talking to me earlier on. We're thinking trade this morning on Times Radio. We are leafing through Liz Truss's In Trade. We keep hearing a lot about this Australian trade deal, but what about the prospects for one for the US, for Canada? We've just taken a hop, skip and a jump through some of them. But let's pick the brain of trade expert now. Sam Lowe is an expert in international trade policy and a senior research fellow at the Centre for European Reform. Morning, Sam.
Good morning.
First of all, on the Australian trade deal and the Prime Minister's suggestion that that's going to be wrapped up by the G7, he hopes, how likely is that, do you think?
I think it's quite probable that it will be wrapped up by then. It seems to be certainly the ambition of the UK and the Australians, I think, are keen to get a win as well. You know, getting it done before the New Zealanders certainly plays well at home.
And in terms of what has happened with that and what has been gained, so some of the concessions on the UK side, this is our first post-Brexit non-EU rollover trade deal, correct me if I'm wrong. So what does that mean for future trade deals, be that with, you know, Canada, as we've been hearing about, or the US?
Yeah, so it's a good question, because a lot of the discussion around the Australia-UK agreement and the negotiations of it have been around this idea that the UK is going to offer duty and quota free trade to the Australians, which means no tariffs at all.
Yeah.
And this is in and of itself unusual between developed countries, in that usually there's some tariffs remain in place, largely for agri-food type products, and those are dealt with via tariff rate quotas. So we're talking about quite an ambitious level of tariff liberalisation. And I suppose the question is, does this create a precedent, or is it a template for the UK's negotiations with other countries in future? And my sort of view on this is that I think that if the the Australia deal truly is duty and quota free. That does indeed set a precedent for the negotiations with New Zealand. Mm. But beyond that, it's quite hard to be certain because the context changes quite a lot. Because you were discussing Canada before this, you know, it's very unlikely the Canadians are going to want duty and quota free trade because they want to, going to want to be able to continue to protect their dairy industry.
Yeah.
In the absence of reciprocity, it's unlikely the UK will offer them the same. And, you know, the same is true of the US. It would be true of other countries such as India and the like, you know, that we've expressed an interest in. So I'm cautious on the precedent point just because it's there's not that many countries in the world that are going to actually want duty and quota free trade.
But what about other areas? We keep hearing about agri-food so often whenever we talk about these trade deals. But I wouldn't necessarily know how big of a chunk it is in terms of our trade between, you know, with the US and Canada. But we services and financial services and the like must surely dwarf it. And I wonder why that doesn't get a mention as often. Is that just because it's a sort of slightly more easier thing to deal with?
So it's easier to discuss tariffs. People can understand that more readily in that we talk about a sort of 10% tax on imports and getting rid of it. When it comes to liberalising services trade, it just gets much more tricky very quickly in that you're talking about regulatory differences, sort of recognition of qualifications and the like. And the truth of the matter is just that trade agreements don't do very much when it comes to opening up new markets for services trade, because it's so difficult to get agreement on these regulatory issues, to recognise, say, that a foreign regulator can sign off that a company operating there is allowed to sell into the UK market, and that if anything goes wrong, it will hold that company to account. It's tricky, and it usually requires deeper levels of regulatory integration and harmonisation. But saying that, we are going to see some progress in some of these areas. We've already saw it with UK-Japan, which was a partial rollover with some bolt-ons last year, yeah, when it had some interesting provisions on digital. So not necessarily opening up new things, but commitments not to, for example, tax data flows or require the onshoring of computer servers. We're going to see more of that in UK-Australia. It might even go further, and I'd assume we see that in UK-Canada and the like. And also we might see some chapters on gender and the like, so because that's something the Canadians are quite keen on. So we will see some additions, but the politics of this often just come down to food, and I'm sure you're thinking talking about it.
Always comes down to cheese in the end. Thank you, yeah. Sam. I appreciate it. That's Sam Lowe from the Centre for European Reform. Live with us, we've also got Angus McNeill, the SNP MP and also Chair of the Parliamentary Select Committee for International Trade. Morning.
Good morning. How's that?
Thanks so much for your time this morning. Would you say that in terms of all the EU deals so far that we've rolled over, the Australian deal is well underway, hoped to be wrapped up by the G7, work is underway for trade deals beyond that, we're in good shape so far in terms of our post-Brexit deal striking?
Well, we have to ask ourselves what the deals are for and what we're hoping to achieve as a current UK. I suppose when I look at the UK government, I've said this for a while, they've got the air of Neville Chamberlain coming back with a piece of paper shouting peace in our time. They've got the air of coming back desperately shouting trade deals in our time. And I think the Australians, in particular, and the New Zealanders also understand this. And they've been quite audacious in their ask, and they've been quite successful. I mean, I know to use the cricket analogy of sort of England, Australia, there's quite a rivalry there in something called the Ashes. The victory here by Australia is probably likely to dwarf that. They've been bold and they've got one over the Poms, and they probably can't believe quite what they've got. They've got a backup market if anything goes wrong for them in the Far East. It's quite an amazing. I mean, you should take your hats off to Australia for what they've achieved here. It's not so good for farmers on this side with that sort of Damocles hanging over them. But you know, if the UK walks out of, and the root of this is numbers and economics, and innumeracy is the friend of Brexit, but I'm going to try with some numbers here. The cost of Brexit to the UK is 4.9% of GDP, and the gain from an Australian trade deal is 0.02%. Now, if I put that in just another set of figures, it's like throwing away £4.90 for a 2p gain, that's 245 times smaller. And for that 2p gain, you're risking and playing fast and loose with farming in the current UK. That is not, from a UK point of view, that is not very good. Mm. From an Australian point of view, I mean, they've hit the boundary and or whatever, hit a six from each and every over and each and every ball. this is the best ASIAS series that they've ever had. And, you know, it's UK farming that's going to end up in ASIAS potentially and, as a result.
I mean, I don't necessarily want to relitigate the Brexit referendum, but in terms of the situation that we find ourselves in now, and as we were just hearing from Sam Lowe, the issue does, as you've also mentioned, always quite quickly comes down to farming and to food. It seems like there could be some quite creative workarounds in terms of risks to the UK market. We were just hearing about the possible UK-US free trade agreement, and actually there might be a way in which you can actually open up access between the two countries in a free market, but actually chlorinated chicken doesn't come in. It's only food that actually meets our standards which can come in from the US. You can have a kind of two-tariff flexible system.
I mean, that sounds fine when you start off, but then it's whack-a-mole, this. Well, then what is your interaction then with your nearest, largest neighbour on your doorstep, who happens to be a massive trading bloc that's bigger than the USA? What do they do to your products if you've got this stuff coming in? Now, remember, there's nothing really wrong with the chlorine in the chicken. We have chlorinated lettuce all the time. Yes. What's wrong with chlorinated chicken is because of the hygiene standards, they have to chlorinate the chicken to make sure that less people have food poisoning. So that's sort of one of the arguments against that. But once you start opening your door to that, that seems fine domestically, but it's the reaction of your neighbour that you've got a lot more trade with. And if they have an allergic reaction to that, you've got greater troubles and you've stored up greater troubles. And this is why the numbers are going, the 4.9% of GDP hit that is Brexit. The UK government's idea and the way they've sold this to many people is to have trade deals to make it up. But the trade deals, even with America, is a fraction of the damage of Brexit. And all the trade deals in every country in the world at the best are probably going to make up, let me see, about a seventh or an eighth of the damage of Brexit. So the UK is risking a lot in trade deals, and every other country in the world knows this. When the UK comes knocking at the door for a trade deal, here they go, rub our hands, they're desperate for a trade deal, we're not. If they're desperate to sell and we're not desperate to buy, obviously in that situation you've got a bargain coming on. And as I pointed out in the beginning, the Australians have done well here. They've really done very well.
There we go, done and dusted. We have solved all international trade concerns for the UK. We've done the job. You're welcome. That is it from the podcast. Thanks very much for downloading. Do join me again tomorrow. We're going to be hearing from another professor, Susan Mickey, actually, I think it is, who we're talking to tomorrow, who has an incredible story about the things that she was researching. Remember, if you like the podcast, if you click like or stars, five stars, whatever that is, do that. It's a good thing. Subscribing also helps. I'm Luke Jones, sitting in for Matt Chorley. I'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.